Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you need that shortcut to being really well-informed, well, you're definitely in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
We've dug into this really extensive interview transcript. I mean, a goldmine of insights from a top talent management expert.
Yeah, it was quite something.
So our mission today is basically to boil down the biggest challenges and the most vital skills for, you know, truly great modern leadership.
And look, this isn't just theory. The stakes right now in talent management, they're huge. A lot of it is demographics, really.
Right.
When talent pros talk succession planning, I mean, they're not just worried about an empty seat. The real headache, the really tough problem, is keeping that institutional knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even more importantly, the wisdom that walks out the door when experienced people retire.
That's such a good way to put it, that urgency.
Mm.
Because, yeah, you can write down a process, right? Put it in a manual.
Sure.
But bottling up like 30 years of making tough calls, mentoring, navigating the internal politics, that's the wisdom piece. You can't just document that easily.
No.
So, yeah, to stay afloat with everything changing so fast, we have to know what makes a leader actually capable of, you know, capturing that and developing it in the next wave of people.
And that exact challenge, that knowledge retention piece, it puts immediate pressure on how we even promote people in the first place.
Okay, let's get into that structure then. Because the research we looked at, it talked about these three hats a leader wears.
Right, the hats.
And this is where things get tricky, because these roles, they often clash. So hat number one, the technical contributor.
Still doing the job, basically.
Yeah, the leader's still expected to be, you know, partly active. The accounting manager still has to close the book sometimes, that kind of thing.
Then hat number two, the manager of process and output. This is the organizational stuff, making sure workflows, deadlines get hit, resources are there. It's management, plain and simple.
But not leadership.
Not leadership. That's hat three, the one that often gets, well, neglected because it's heavy lifting. The true leader of people.
Development, coaching, mentoring, vision, all that.
Exactly. And the problem, and the research hits this hard, calls it a massive organizational failure, is what you could call the promotion misstep.
Okay.
Organizations promote people almost purely based on how good they are technically. You know, the best coder, suddenly they're the engineering manager.
Or the top salesperson is now VP of sales.
Yeah.
Those tech skills, the very things that got them promoted, they have almost zero connection to succeeding in hat three, leading actual people.
Precisely. And when you take that star performer, that technical whiz, and put them in charge without prepping them for the people side, well, that causes ripples. Big ones.
How so?
Well, think about it. You've lost your best individual contributor, right? And you've potentially created a stressed out, maybe even damaging, mediocre manager. The cost isn't just morale. It's people leaving. It's failure to delegate. The whole system slows down.
Wow. Okay. So if the technical stuff is just like the entry fee.
Table stakes. Yeah.
Then the real need is to coach and develop everything beyond that. We're talking specific behaviors, relationship skills, maybe even just preferences for leading people.
Exactly. Which, you know, brings us to the obvious question. What does great leadership actually look like then?
Well, the expert we studied, they talked about this brilliant exercise. I think it was used at Benjamin Moore, called My Best Boss.
Oh, yeah. That one's powerful.
It just cuts through all the corporate jargon, right? Asks people, think about your best boss ever. What did they actually do?
And when you sift through thousands of answers from exercises like that, the attributes people mention overwhelmingly about how the leader treated them, not about process. It's behavior.
Right. So the first one that comes up constantly is empowerment, and not just, here, do this task.
No, it's giving them the actual authority, the budget, maybe, the autonomy to really own the solution.
Then the second is someone you can learn from. But again, not just transactionally, like, they taught me pivot tables.
Right. It's deeper. It's how they handle things, how they navigate conflict, the personal example they set. You learn by watching them be.
Third, and this one really resonates, somebody who genuinely believes in you. As a person, I remember this one boss I had gave me this huge project way over my head, I thought.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I don't know if I'm ready. And they just looked at me and said, I wouldn't ask you if you weren't.
Mm.
That belief, it changes things.
Oh, absolutely. Transformative is the right word. And fourth, someone who advocates for you.
Speaks up for you.
Yeah. Recognizes your strengths and actually uses them. Make sure other people see what you bring to the table. Those four things together. Empowerment, learning, belief, advocacy, that builds serious loyalty and performance.
Okay, so if those are the key positive behaviors, What's the engine driving them? Mm-hmm. What allows a leader to do those things consistently? Is this where emotional intelligence comes in?
Bingo. That's exactly it. EI, emotional intelligence, it's the bedrock for all those so-called soft skills.
Right.
Essentially, EI is about understanding and managing your own emotions, right? Mm-hmm. Self-awareness, and then recognizing, understanding, and influencing the emotions of others. Social skill.
So a high EI leader knows why they're reacting a certain way.
Uh-huh.
And knows how to give feedback without making someone defensive.
Exactly. Without EI, that empowerment we talked about, it can just become dumping work. And advocacy can feel kind of empty, just transactional praise. EI makes it genuine.
That makes total sense. So these great attributes, they really only work if there's this foundation of trust, which I think takes us deeper into the research, this idea of vulnerable trust and psychological safety.
Yes. And let's make a quick distinction first, because it's important. There's reliability and then there's trust.
Okay.
Reliability is, you know, procedural. Showing up on time, hitting deadlines, doing what you said you'd do. We respect that. It builds some trust for sure.
But it's not the whole picture.
No. What we ultimately trust, the kind of trust that creates real psychological safety, it's trusting people, their character, their intent.
So what does vulnerable trust look like on a team?
It means feeling safe enough to, one, own your mistakes, and two, crucially, to ask questions when you really don't have a clue.
And leadership has to model that.
Absolutely have to. When a leader can say, you know, looking back at that project, I think we misread the market, we could have done this better, that's vulnerability.
Or even sharing something personal. Being human.
Yeah. Admitting a challenge outside work, just showing who they are, it creates what the source called a soft place to land for everyone else.
Okay, wait. Isn't that a huge culture change for most places?
Yeah.
How does a leader go from being the expert, the one promoted because they knew the answers, to being the person who admits flaws without losing authority?
That takes real courage because you're right. Vulnerability is often seen as weakness, but in leadership, it's actually strength.
How so?
It signals to the team, hey, I'm not perfect, so you don't have to be either. It frees people up to take smart risks, to innovate, without being paralyzed by fear of messing up.
Okay. To give this some structure, the research mentioned Tim Clark's four levels of psychological safety as a kind of model for how trust builds.
Yeah, Clark's model is really helpful here. Level one is inclusion safety. Super fundamental. Do I feel like I belong here?
Just as I am.
Just as you are. Regardless of background, identity, whatever, can I bring my whole self or do I need to wear a mask? That's inclusion safety.
Got it. Level two.
Learner safety. This is where that vulnerability piece really kicks in. Do I feel safe enough to make mistakes? To ask the dumb questions? To take a calculated risk to learn something new?
So like if the new person building a complex spreadsheet makes a mistake.
Yeah. Do they hide it because they're scared of getting yelled at or embarrassed?
Yeah.
Or do they flag it early because it's safe to learn? Learner safety saves organizations huge headaches down the line.
Makes sense. Level three.
Contributor safety. Do I feel like my ideas, my opinions, my thoughts will actually be heard and valued? Or will they just get shot down?
So even the most junior person feels okay speaking up in a brainstorming session.
That's the goal. Their voice matters just as much as the VP's in that moment.
And the final level. The hardest one.
Level four, challenger safety. This is the peak. Can you actually tell your leader they might be wrong? Can you respectfully challenge a strategic direction or point out an ethical concern?
Without fearing for your job or career.
Exactly. Without fear of retribution. And if you don't have challenger safety, you basically kill innovation. The organization is just running on the leader's blind spot.
Which is incredibly risky.
Hugely risky. Mature, high-trust teams, they operate at level four. If the team can't tell the CEO the new strategy has major flaws, that CEO is flying blind.
Wow. The cost of not having this safety seems enormous. Wasted time, hidden mistakes, stalled growth.
Absolutely.
So if these things are so obviously crucial, why aren't all leaders doing them? What are the barriers?
Well, the number one thing leaders cite, it's the classic, I just don't have the time.
Right. I'm too busy putting out fires to coach anyone.
Exactly. They see leadership development, coaching, those one-on-ones. They see it as another task on an already overflowing plate, an add-on, a burden.
And the expert's take on that
was basically, you have to completely reframe it.
Mm.
The solution isn't finding separate time. It's integration.
Meaning?
You don't schedule coaching hour. You weave development into the daily work, into the existing flow.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Think about preparing a big client presentation, Instead of just assigning sections,
mm-hmm.
you sit down with your direct report. You co-design the strategy. You talk through why you're making certain choices. You coach the delegation piece right there in
yeah.
the moment using the real work. You're teaching complex skills through the task itself.
Ah, okay. So the daily work becomes the coaching opportunity.
Precisely. That reframing deals with the time excuse. But as the research pointed out, even when you get past the time issue, there are deeper things holding leaders back. More psychological obstacles.
Like what?
Well, it often comes down to ego and insecurity, honestly. First, there's just a basic fear of failure, which makes leaders cling to what they know, the old, comfortable ways. They can't get out of the way of their own ego.
And second?
A fear of obsolescence. This one's subtle but powerful. It's this nagging worry. If I develop my team too well, if I make them really capable,
will they take my job?
Exactly. Will I make myself redundant? Will I be out of a job?
And that fear leads to
possessiveness, holding on to key tasks too tightly, refusing to delegate the really important strategic stuff, which of course prevents anyone else from learning and growing.
Becoming a bottleneck.
A total bottleneck. And guaranteeing that when they eventually do leave, all that crucial knowledge and wisdom walks out the door with them. The very problem we started with.
Wow. It all seems to circle back to mindset then. This sounds exactly like the difference between a fixed and a growth mindset.
Absolutely, the fixed mindset leader. They're often terrified of vulnerability because they think competence is static. If I admit I messed up, I'm just fundamentally flawed.
So they stick to the status quo. We're doing fine. Why rock the boat?
Right. They resist integrating coaching because deep down, they might fear their team surpassing them.
Whereas the growth mindset leader
sees everything as a chance to learn. Adapting constantly, looking for ways to get better, admitting a mistake. For them, it's just data. It's information needed for improvement, not some judgment on their character.
So they embrace vulnerability. And they see their team's success as reflecting well on them.
Exactly. Their strength is developing others. Now, we do need balance, right? An organization can't be pure chaos.
Sure, you need stability. Keep the lights on.
You need that strong operational, core, reliable processes. But without that growth mindset engine constantly pushing for improvement, for evolution, that core eventually just stagnates. You got to keep what works, but always look for that edge.
Okay, so wrapping this up.
Yeah.
If you're a newer leader listening to this, or maybe someone moving into a more strategic role, what's the core advice we've pulled from this deep dive?
I think first and foremost, see leadership as a transformation, not just a transaction.
Meaning it's not just about paychecks and tasks.
Right. It's about fundamental change in you, in your team, in what the whole organization can achieve.
Okay.
Second, listen more than you talk. Seriously. The best insights often come from the people doing the actual work. And be genuinely open to learning how to lead. It's a skill. You practice it. You don't just get it with the promotion.
Makes sense.
And third,
prioritize the relational stuff, those soft skills,
mm-hmm.
trust, listening, empathy, advocating for your people. They aren't soft at all.
Yeah.
They're the absolute core capabilities for leading today. They're the real hard skills.
Yeah.
Be a human first.
Be human first. Okay. That leaves us with maybe one final thought, kind of pulling all these threads together.
Yeah.
We've talked about creating safety, being vulnerable, modeling emotional intelligence. If a leader actually manages to integrate coaching, if they conquer their ego enough to get to that level 4 challenger safety,
which is the really hard part.
Right. Then the shift isn't just about behavior, is it? It sounds almost physiological. Well, think about it. If you're doing those things successfully, you're literally shifting your team's collective nervous system, moving them from a state of maybe low-grade threat or anxiety.
Your fight or flight.
Yeah, towards a state of engagement, creativity, innovation. So perhaps the next deep dive for you, the listener, to think about is this. How do these concepts, relational leadership, vulnerable trust, psychological safety, directly impact things like team resilience? Adaptability, and maybe even how could we measure that, not just in surveys, but in real outcomes like less burnout or faster, better decision making.
Something to definitely chew on. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.